Welcome to Defenders, the teaching class of Dr. William Lane Craig. Today, part 19 of The Doctrine of Christ. For more resources, including articles, books, podcasts, audio, and video, go to reasonablefaith.org.
Let's go to our lesson this morning, which is on the resurrection of Jesus. It's such a delight to be talking about this topic at this season of the year as we approach Easter. Last time, we looked at the evidence for the burial by Jesus by Joseph of Arimathea in a tomb. And today, we want to come to the subject of the empty tomb of Jesus. That is my second fact that has been agreed to by the majority of New Testament scholars. On the Sunday following his crucifixion, Jesus' tomb was found empty by a group of his women followers. Now, when we come to the empty tomb story, we're immediately confronted with the difficulty that these accounts of the empty tomb in the various Gospels are not harmonious. They are inconsistent with each other, and that has caused some persons to be worried about their historicity. For example, Bart Ehrman says that the accounts we have of Jesus' resurrection, and he's thinking here primarily the empty tomb narrative, are hopelessly contradictory in their details. He says it's an interesting exercise to make a list of the similarities and differences. He says the accounts don't agree about who went to visit Jesus' tomb on the third day, what did they see once they got there, what were they told when they arrived at the tomb, what did they do as a result of being told to do something. All these things are different in the Gospels in ways that are very difficult to reconcile. So you have the problem that the empty tomb narratives have various inconsistencies in the details. However, what needs to be understood is, as Ehrman puts it, these are in the secondary details. These sorts of discrepancies are to be found among any collection of independent historical accounts of some event. The core of the narrative, however, is identical across the accounts, even if they differ in the secondary details. And this is quite common in ancient history. For example, the ancient historians Livy and Polybius give two irreconcilable accounts of Hannibal's crossing the Alps to attack Rome during the Punic Wars. But nobody doubts that Hannibal did mount such a campaign, trying to use elephants to attack Rome during the war. So that even though the accounts are irreconcilable that we have, the basic fact remains historically attested and acknowledged that, in fact, Hannibal did attempt to cross the Alps and bring an attack upon Rome. And when you look at the accounts, what you find is that we have very good grounds for affirming the historical reliability of their core, and Ehrman himself admits this. Let me quote you from Ehrman's lectures with the teaching company. This is what he says. There are a couple of things that we can say for certain about Jesus after his death. We can say with relative certainty, for example, that he was buried. The accounts are fairly unanimous in saying, the earliest accounts we have are unanimous in saying, that Jesus was in fact buried by this fellow, Joseph of Arimathea. And so it's relatively reliable that that's what happened. We also have solid traditions to indicate that women found this tomb empty 3 days later. This is attested in all our gospel sources, early and late, and so it appears to be a historical datum. And so I think we can say that after Jesus' death, with some certainty, that he was buried, possibly by this fellow Joseph of Arimathea, and that 3 days later he appeared not to have been in the tomb. So that from Ehrman, one of the most skeptical of the New Testament critics about the historical Jesus. Michael Grant is a historian who wrote a book called Jesus, an Historian's Review of the Gospels, and this is what he says. True, the discovery of the empty tomb is differently described by the various Gospels, but if we apply the same sort of criteria that we would apply to any other ancient literary sources, then the evidence is firm and plausible enough to necessitate the conclusion that the tomb was indeed found empty. So that's a very strong statement by a secular historian that despite the discrepancies in the secondary details, the evidence is firm and plausible enough to necessitate the conclusion that the tomb was in fact found empty. Indeed, the Gospels agree, all four of them agree with the following set of facts. Jesus of Nazareth was crucified in Jerusalem by Roman authority during the Passover feast, having been arrested and convicted on charges of blasphemy by the Jewish Sanhedrin, and then slandered before the governor Pilate on charges of treason. He died within several hours and was buried Friday afternoon by Joseph of Arimathea in a tomb which was shut with a stone. Certain women followers of Jesus, including Mary Magdalene, she is always named, having observed his interment, visited his tomb early on Sunday morning only to find it empty. Thereafter, Jesus appeared alive from the dead to the disciples, including Peter, again, who is always named, who then became proclaimers of the message of his resurrection. All four Gospels attest to those facts. And you can add many, many more details if you will include facts attested in three out of the four Gospels. So even though there are discrepancies between the empty tomb narrative, these are not significant enough to lead even skeptical scholars to think that the fact as I've stated it, namely on the Sunday following the crucifixion, Jesus' tomb was found empty by a group of his women followers, is not historically well attested. On the contrary, they think that is historically well attested. Now, let me go into some of the reasons that have led scholars to this conclusion. Remember, Michael Grant says, when you assess these narratives by the standard criteria that historians use, then it is plausible and, plausible and firm enough that this tomb had to have been empty. So let me mention some of the factors that lead to this conclusion. 5 points. Number one, the empty tomb story is also part of the old Passion source used by Mark. Remember last week we talked about the pre-Markan Passion story that Mark used in writing his gospel and that goes back to the earliest days of the Jerusalem church. The Passion source that Mark used did not end with defeat and death. It didn't end with the burial story. Rather, it ended with the empty tomb story. It is after the empty tomb story that the Gospels then begin to diverge again in telling different appearances of Jesus that are appended to the empty tomb account. But grammatically speaking, we really have just one story, namely the burial and empty tomb. These are grammatically and linguistically tied together and represent the close of the pre-Markan Passion source. So this empty tomb account is not some sort of late accruing legend that came to pass decades after Jesus was dead and gone. No, this goes back to the very earliest sources in the Jerusalem church. Second, the old tradition that's quoted by Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 3 to 5, implies the fact of the empty tomb. Remember we said that in 1 Corinthians 15, 3 to 5, Paul is not writing freely in his own hand. He is quoting an old tradition that scholars date to go within the first 5 years after Jesus' crucifixion. And the third and fourth lines of that, the second and the third lines are that Christ was buried and he was raised on the third day. And for any first century Jew to say of a dead man that he was buried and he was raised would imply that a vacant grave was left behind. A first century Jew could not have thought otherwise. The resurrection meant the physical raising up of the corpse. Moreover, notice that peculiar expression, on the third day. Since nobody actually saw Jesus get up and walk out of the tomb, so far as we know, why did the early church date the resurrection on the third day? Why not on the seventh day, the God's perfect number, or the tenth day? Why the third day? Well, I think that the answer is that it was on the third day after his crucifixion, according to Jewish reckoning, that the women found the tomb empty. And so naturally, the resurrection itself came to be dated on that day. Moreover, the four-line tradition, which is summarized by Paul here in 1 Corinthians 15, summarizes both the passion story on the one hand in the Gospels and the early apostolic preaching in the book of Acts on the other hand. Look at Acts chapter 13, verses 28 to 31 for an example. Acts chapter 13, verses 28 to 31. This represents the early apostolic preaching of the gospel. And in verse 28, they say, even though they could charge him with nothing deserving death, yet they asked Pilate to have him killed. That's line one. Christ died for our sins. Verse 29, and when they had fulfilled all that was written of him, they took him down from the tree and laid him in a tomb. That's line two. And he was buried. Verse 30, but God raised him from the dead. That's line three of Paul's formula. And he was raised on the third day. And verse 31, and for many days he appeared to those who came up with him from Galilee to Jerusalem, who are now his witnesses to the people. That's line four of Paul's formula. And he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. So Paul presents in 1 Corinthians 15, 11, this four-line formula as a summary of the apostolic preaching. And here we have independently in the book of Acts confirmation of that. This is like an outline of the apostolic preaching that Paul gives here. Now, when you turn over to your Gospel of Mark, the earliest of the four Gospels, what corresponds to these four lines that Paul gives here? Well, look at your Gospel of Mark, chapter 15 and 16. In chapter 15, from verses 33 to 41, you have the death of Jesus. That's the first line. Then, from verse 42 to the end of the chapter, verse 47, you have the burial in the tomb. That's the second line of the formula. Then, verse 16, 1 to 6, you have the story of the empty tomb. That's the third line, and he was raised. And then the fourth line, and he appeared, that is foreshadowed in the words of the angel in verse 7. Tell his disciples and Peter, interesting, he's named there, that he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him, as he told you. So the appearances then are foreshadowed. So what corresponds to the third line of Paul's formula? And he was raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures. It's the story of the empty tomb. So what this formula summarizes in its third line, and he was raised, is the empty tomb story, the verb, and he was raised, correlating to the words of the angel, he is risen, in the empty tomb account. So, again, we have, I think, significant, very, very early evidence for the empty tomb that is found in this pre-Pauline formula, which states that he was buried and he was raised on the third day. And that correlates to both the apostolic preaching and the story of Jesus' passion and resurrection in the Gospels. Number three, Mark's story of the discovery of the empty tomb is remarkably simple, and it lacks any signs of legendary embellishment. You don't have in the Markan account the sort of theological and apologetical motifs that would characterize a later legendary account. It's lacking any sort of theological or apologetical reflection. The best way to appreciate this is to simply read the Markan account in contrast to the accounts of the resurrection found in the later apocryphal Gospels. These were forgeries from the second century and later. For example, in the so-called Gospel of Peter, which is a forgery from the second half of the second century after Christ, the tomb is surrounded by a Roman guard, and it is explicitly identified as Roman. No doubt here now, this is a Roman guard, according to the Gospel of Peter. Moreover, the guard is not set on Saturday. It's set on Friday. That ensures that no one could have had any hanky-panky going on Friday night before the tomb was guarded on Saturday, as Matthew records it. That apologetical gap, you see, has been closed now by the Gospel of Peter. The guard is sent immediately, and it's a Roman guard. Moreover, the tomb is surrounded by all of the chief priests and the Pharisees who are watching the tomb, and there's a huge crowd from the surrounding countryside who have all come to watch the tomb. So you've got all the official witnesses there, right? Not unqualified women. You've got the Jewish leadership watching the tomb. Now what happens? In the night, a voice rings out from heaven, and the stone over the door of the tomb rolls back by itself. And then two men come out of heaven. Two men descend from heaven and go into the tomb. And then, a moment later, three men come out of the tomb. And the heads of the two men reach up to the clouds. But the head of the third man, who is apparently sitting on the shoulders of the other two, he's being supported by the other two as they bring him out, his head overpasses the clouds. And then a cross comes out of the tomb, and a voice from heaven asks, "Hast thou preached to them that sleep?" And the cross answers, "Yea." Now see, these are how real legends look. They are filled with all sorts of apologetical and theological motifs that are starkly absent from the Markan account, which is just remarkable in its simplicity. It's a bare-boned account that I think suggests this is not the product of legend. Number four, the fact that women's testimony was regarded as less reliable than men's testimony in first century Jewish society counts in favor of the fact that it was women who discovered the empty tomb. The first century Jewish historian Josephus says that the testimony of women was regarded so lightly that it couldn't even be admitted into a Jewish court of law. He says, "Do not admit the testimony of women because of the brashness and levity of their sex." In other words, females are brash airheads, and therefore don't admit their testimony into a court of law. Now, think of that. Any later legendary account of the empty tomb would surely have made male disciples like Peter and John discover the empty tomb. The fact that it is women whose testimony was regarded as worthless that are the chief witnesses to the fact of the empty tomb is best explained by the fact that, like it or not, they were the discoverers of the empty tomb, and the gospel writers record what for them was a rather awkward and embarrassing fact. Finally, number five, the earliest Jewish allegation that the disciples had stolen Jesus' body. This is found in Matthew 28:15, where Matthew recounts the story of the guard at the tomb and how the Jewish leadership says, "Tell people his disciples came by night and stole him away while we slept." And Matthew says, this story has been spread among Jews until this day. This allegation that they had stolen the body shows that the body was in fact missing from the tomb. What was the earliest Jewish response to the disciples' proclamation, "He is risen from the dead"? Did they point to the corpse in the tomb, in the hillside? Did they say, "These men are full of new wine"? No, they said, "His disciples came and stole away his body." Now think about that. The disciples came and stole away his body. The earliest Jewish response to the proclamation of the resurrection in Jerusalem was itself an attempt to explain why the body was missing. So we've got evidence here for the historicity of the empty tomb that is absolutely top drawer, because it comes not from the Christians, it comes from the enemies of the early Christian movement that Matthew was concerned to refute. So for these and many other reasons, the majority of New Testament historians concur that, in fact, Jesus' tomb was probably found empty on the Sunday morning following his crucifixion by a group of his women followers. According to Jakob Kramer, who was an Austrian specialist in the resurrection, died this last year, he said, "By far, most exegetes hold firmly to the reliability of the biblical statements concerning the empty tomb." Well, we're out of time, so we'll take any questions next time we meet on the historicity of the empty tomb. But in the meantime, I wish you all a good week.
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig. For more, go to reasonablefaith.org.